شيل شيل عالجمة لي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
You're tuned in to This Week in Palestine, a space where truth is not trimmed to reassure the powerful, where resistance is not poetry, but the rhythm of daily survival, and where solidarity is not a passing gesture, but a heartbeat carried from one generation to the next. From the heart of occupation, voices rise, not in isolation, not as whispers swallowed by empire, but together, in chorus with movements across the world that demand justice, dignity, and liberation for all people. This is not merely a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretched from Gaza to every corner of the globe, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding rubble to resolve, binding grief to a future still worth imagining. It is a reminder that even in the deepest night, the flame of defiance refuses to go out. Each week, we bring you reporting that refuses euphemism, analysis that cuts through distortion, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not sanitize. We do not soften. We speak plainly, because the stakes are far too high for anything less than truth. We trace the architecture of power, the policies that suffocate, the narratives that erase, the weapons that silence, and we follow their echoes across borders. From Ferguson to Jenin, from refugee camps to classrooms, from Gaza to the global conscience. This Week in Palestine is not a program of polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without apology. Because the struggle for liberation is not confined to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred.
ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله ناصر على نجوم الليل انا داويل.
Before we begin, a brief reminder. The views expressed in this hour belong to our hosts and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC Boston College or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite avoidance or softened language. This is a space for truth bold, urgent, and unapologetic. Good morning. Good evening. Wherever you're tuning in from, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Bethany Marks, and it's an honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, January 4th, 2026. On this night, one of the longest nights of the year, our gaze turns once more to Gaza and the West Bank. Lands under siege, enduring what no land should endure. We look toward the ruins where homes once stood, toward lives uprooted under a weight of global indifference that feels heavier than the earth itself. As headlines fade, one truth remains. Palestinians continue to resist, even now, even as the shadow of reinvasion stretches across the horizon. Let's be honest. Peace was never the goal of the occupier. The goal has always been opportunity, to erase, to uproot, to redraw history with bulldozers and bombs. And the world watches some in silence, others in open complicity. So we must ask, when will the world reckon with the cost of its silence? When will conscience outweigh convenience? How long must a people suffer before their lives are seen as sacred? Stay with us as we strip away the silence, as we uplift the resilient, as we hold space for truth that refuses to be buried.
شيل شيل عالجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College.
ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله ناصر على نجوم الليل انا داويلو.
Up next, we're sharing a brief segment from a recent conversation featuring analyst Ali Abunama, titled Israel's Catastrophic Failure. In this clip, Abunama breaks down how Israel's political and military strategies have unraveled in the wake of the Gaza War, and how these failures are reshaping regional dynamics. He examines the shifting global response, the cracks in traditional alliances, and what this moment reveals about the limits of power in the modern Middle East. Let's listen.
شيل على جمال شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
So today I'm speaking with the legendary Ali Abunama, the founder of Electronic Intifada, the digital news platform that's been covering everything Palestine for over 24 years now. They've been doing excellent work, and it's actually because of their articles and their explainer videos that I'm able to do my work, particularly after October 7th, debunking much of the atrocity propaganda lies. Really, it's just amplifying the work that they have done. So, Ali, thank you so much for being here. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Iran-Israel war. What was your takeaway, not only about the political developments, but also the damage that Israeli society was subjected to for the first time, really, it seems like ever?
Hi, Ahmed, and thank you for your kind words. And I greatly appreciate your work. You do such an amazing job of getting real information out to people. Well, very simply, what happened is that Israel, with the support of the United States, launched what was apparently a well-planned and long-planned surprise attack on Iran on June 13th. The pretext was Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because there's no evidence that it's anything other than a peaceful nuclear energy program. That was the pretext. The real goal was to collapse the Islamic Republic of Iran, to collapse the government and bring about regime change. And it failed spectacularly. They thought that the Iranian system would collapse within a day or two by this shock and awe campaign of taking out top commanders, putting out this propaganda, calling on the Iranian people to rise up. And they thought that Iran was a house of cards and it would collapse like other regimes in the region that they have targeted. That didn't happen. The Iranian people rallied around the state, even those who oppose it, because Iran is a country with a great deal of political diversity. And I've heard several Iranians saying that they have not seen this kind of national unity since Iraq invaded the country in 1980 at the behest of Western powers at the time. And Iran instead rallied. Within the same day, it replaced the murdered military commanders and launched a fierce counterattack against Israel. And instead of showing Israel's strength, this attack demonstrated to the whole world Israel's weakness, because the Iranian ballistic missiles were able to just get through the multi-layered U.S. and Israeli missile shields. And as time went on, they were doing increasing damage, of which we've only seen a fraction because of the heavy military censorship in Israel. But what we've seen is enough to tell us that Israel could not stand this for very much longer, and their interceptors were about to run out. And it wasn't just the physical destruction, it was also the fact that Israel's only international airport was shut down, its ports were shut down, its oil refinery is still shut down, its economy was shut down, and Israel was unable to defend itself, even with the might of the United States behind it, with the U.S. Navy missile destroyers in the Mediterranean, with the U.S. THAAD anti-missile systems, with various allied air forces, including in neighboring Arab states, working night and day to shoot down drones and missiles. Iran was exposed as completely naked. Israel was exposed as completely naked. And for the first time, the Israeli people on a mass scale realized that they do not have immunity to just enjoy days at the beach while Israel is perpetrating genocide in Gaza, genocide in Lebanon, bombing Yemen, that they could not continue to enjoy this first world lifestyle, carefree lifestyle, while murdering and massacring the indigenous people of the region. So it was a massive strategic defeat for Israel. They didn't achieve a single one of their goals. Netanyahu came out and declared a historic victory. He said that we defeated the nuclear weapons threat and the ballistic missiles threat. Obvious nonsense. Now everybody knows that the U.S. strike on the Iranian nuclear sites was just political theater, and that nobody even knows where Iran's enriched uranium is, and the U.S. intelligence assessment that came out and said that at best, the U.S. may have set Iran's nuclear programs back by a few months. And of course, just the absolute lie that the ballistic missile program was defeated when Israel was hammered by salvo after salvo of ballistic missiles to the last minute. And then, of course, the real goal, regime change, failed. Having said all that, people have to recognize that this was a one round in an ongoing war, that the U.S. and Israeli determination to destroy Iran as a sovereign state will not relent. And the purpose of them targeting Iran is simple. It's because Iran is a sovereign country that is something that is intolerable to the United States, which can only tolerate puppet regimes. And even worse, it is a sovereign country that supports the resistance in Palestine and other countries in the region. That and that alone is why Iran is number one on the target list. And they failed this time, the United States and Israel, but they will come back for another try.
So in the lead up to this, there was the potential for Netanyahu's government to collapse. I believe a couple of hours before the attack, or a day before the attack, there was a last second agreement to keep the coalition intact. And we've been hearing for the last 2 years that Benjamin Netanyahu is on the political hot seat, that the government could collapse at any moment. That hasn't happened yet. People have said that Netanyahu started this war with Iran in order to extend his political career. Do you agree with that assessment? What was Netanyahu's calculus here? Was this a war for his career, or was this a war for Israel's interests to defeat and destroy Iran, the only enemy really opposed to them in the region? Or is it a combination of the two?
I think it's mostly the latter. I mean, I don't know what the timing was. I don't think that an operation as complex as the one Israel mounted can be just conjured up at the convenience of Netanyahu. It must have been something that was planned for a very long time, and they may have had some discretion about when to launch it, but we just don't know. What we do know is that the destruction of Iran has been Benjamin Netanyahu's and Israel's primary agenda item for decades, and that for decades, Israel and its lobby have been campaigning for the United States to wage a war against Iran on Israel's behalf. And this isn't new. And I think it's important not to focus too much on Netanyahu. He is, of course, a particularly malevolent individual, but the entire Zionist political spectrum in Israel supported this war. All the so-called opposition leaders came out and supported this war. So we shouldn't have any illusion that this was one man's war, and one man couldn't have mounted it. It took the entire apparatus of the Israeli regime and its spy agencies and its military to carry this out. This was an Israeli Zionist project, not a Benjamin Netanyahu project.
So Israeli society is quite fanatical. They are extreme. They're psychopathic. We have seen the polls where they say that they don't feel as though they're doing enough in Gaza, even after the genocide that we've all been forced to witness. And of course, majority of them supported this war with Iran. What sort of effect would this kind of war now have? Do you see Israeli society shifting in any regard, at least in terms of fear, or are they just hell-bent on further death and destruction?
You know, many people have pointed out that in Iran on Tuesday, the day the cessation of hostilities came into effect, people in Iran immediately went out and celebrated. And I saw pictures and videos of that. Nobody went out and celebrated in Tel Aviv or in Israel. Netanyahu may tell them it was a victory, but I don't think they believe that. And I think Israel is, you know, it's a settler colonial society that is reaching its end and hastening its own end through its behavior. And the deal for these settler colonies is always, you know, whether you talk about apartheid South Africa or Rhodesia or indeed Australia or New Zealand or the United States, is that the settler colonial population can live a comfortable, peaceful, first world lifestyle while the natives suffer. That's the deal. The deal is not that the settler society suffers. So you have to look at the reality for Israelis now. The stable first world life that they could count on is gone, and it's been gone for a while. Yes, of course, it's still there far more than it is for Palestinians or people in Gaza. You know, you can't compare those situations. But there's insecurity, there's instability. The long-term effects of this demonstration of Iranian capability to just, you know, the myth to pierce and destroy the myth of Israel's missile shield, what's the long-term effect of that going to be? It's going to be the acceleration of a brain drain that has already been going on and accelerating for a while. It's going to mean the acceleration of capital flight. I mean, one of the targets Iran hit that we know about, despite the military censorship, was this massive multi-billion dollar Israeli military-led cyber park in Beersheba. This is like the Israeli military's headquarters for cyber warfare and for the IDF's computing division and its so-called C4I division, its cyber command and control and intelligence division. But it was completely integrated with the high-tech sector. So you had Microsoft there, you have IBM there, you have Apple there, you have other American and Western tech firms that are deeply, deeply in bed with the Israeli military and complicit with the genocide. That was pounded with Iranian missiles. And it must have been one of the most heavily defended parts of Israel because this was such a crucial part of the Israeli military's plans. And this is a brand new facility. They've been building it over the last 10 years. It's not even finished yet. So you have to look at that and say, who is going to come and invest billions or tens of billions of dollars in new facilities in this entity that is so vulnerable and more hated than ever, not because of who it is, but because of what it's done and what it's doing and just its aggression and its murderousness. So I think that although Israel launched this war, it had the effect of severely weakening Israel, both in the short term and in the long term. But as it goes, you know, it's often said that a wounded animal is most dangerous. I think that's true with Israel. It's not going to become less aggressive. It's going to become more so. And that's something that I think leaders in Iran and other countries targeted by Israel will have to be aware of and take into account.
That's an excellent point. There was a report earlier today in Turkish media talking about how in the first week, Israel spent $5 billion on the war. You have to imagine that they spent a lot more than that up until the finish line. What sort of cost to the economy other than the reduction of new investment potentially by companies like Microsoft? Is it just the air defense missiles? You talked about how the economy was disrupted, society was disrupted, having to stop work and go into a bunker, things of that nature. So what other sort of economic effects did this recent conflict have, and how might this hurt Israel?
Yeah, the air defense alone, according to Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, was $287 million a night. And that's not just, the problem is not just the cost. The problem is that these air defense missiles cannot be replaced quickly. They can't manufacture them fast enough. Iran can saturate the system very, very quickly, and it exhausted it with just a few hundred missiles. Iran has thousands and thousands of missiles. The exact number is unknown, but Benjamin Netanyahu estimated it at 20,000. And with just a few hundred missiles, Iran could completely deplete the air defense system to the point where Israel had to beg for a ceasefire, basically. And also, of course, Iran was using missiles that became more and more effective at evading the system even that was there. But that's a slight tangent from your question about the economic costs. So there's the direct military costs, but it's much more. There's the short-term costs, of course, that the economy basically shut down, and the effect that that has on morale as well. The fact that the refinery in Haifa is shut down and will probably be shut down for possibly for months at least. Israel's ports, Eilat, has been basically non-functional for more than a year because Ansarullah in Yemen has basically taken it out of commission. That's Israel's Red Sea port. But now Haifa is very vulnerable. Maersk, the major Danish-based shipping group, announced that it was stopping its ships going to Haifa because it was too risky. I don't know if they're going to restart that or if they have now that there is this cessation. But whether that happens or not, you can expect insurance and shipping costs are going to increase dramatically. There will be probably much less foreign direct investment in Israel. Tourism has already collapsed since October 2023, and I think that that's going to become even more of a problem for Israel. They're not going to have a lot of success marketing Israel as a safe and fun tourist destination. And when you have a society that is also spending so much on its military and so many of its prime workforce have to be mobilized all the time, that is a direct drain on the economy. Israel's economy cannot withstand very long mobilizations that, it takes workers out of the economy. And then you have the brain drain, which, as I said, has been a problem for Israel for years, but has really accelerated since October 2023. If you're young, educated, you have, professional skills, particularly in the tech sector, why would you stay in Israel? Its vaunted tech sector is disappearing. All these companies are moving abroad anyway because of the unstable environment in Israel, and you can move, you can have a safer life for your family without having to run to the bomb shelters all the time, probably get a better salary abroad. And so we see record numbers of Israelis leaving the country and not coming back. Record numbers even by Israel's official figures, which are a gross underestimate. So that's also a factor too that drains the economy long term. So I do think that the long-term prospects for Israel are really diminishing.
I want to ask you about October 7th. So Yahya Sinwar plans this operation. Palestinian resistance carries out this operation. Obviously, things have changed quite a bit since October 7th. And in hindsight, at this moment in time, we have the ability to interpret the success or the failure, of this operation. How do you perceive October 7th in terms of its intent to put pressure, I guess, on the Israeli society and the effectiveness in trying to advocate for Palestinian rights? People have questioned whether or not it was the right decision to make. Some people speculate that Sinwar's intention was that this would at some point reach Iran and that there would be a conflict between Iran and Israel. That is something we've just witnessed. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do you perceive or interpret the fallout of October 7th? And in the short term and the long term, has this been better for Palestinians or has it made things worse?
Well, there's no question that the suffering of Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, where Israel's violence is at unprecedented levels, is immense and unbearable and intolerable. We can't diminish that. And it's it's deeply painful. It's something we can never get used to. But Palestinians, no Palestinian is at fault for what Israel has done. Israel is solely responsible for the crimes, for the genocide, for the atrocities it is committing. So even to ask the question is, in a sense, to blame the victims. That, you know, it's like saying, I know that's not your intent, but it's like saying, if you had been well-behaved prisoners, the guards wouldn't have had to beat you. And I don't think we can allow ourselves to frame things that way. Every liberation struggle has been costly for those who have fought for liberation, not because those fighting for liberation brought suffering on themselves, but because their oppressors are cruel, merciless, psychopathic. So millions of people were murdered by the United States and France in Southeast Asia in the liberation struggle from French and American colonialism and imperialism in Vietnam, in Cambodia, and Laos. It wasn't the fault of the Vietnamese and the Cambodians that the United States carpet-bombed them and napalmed them and murdered millions of people. That is solely the responsibility of the United States. You can't say that the Vietnamese were wrong to fight for their liberation because the United States was willing to and did murder millions of them. And that logic applies across the world where people have had to fight for their liberation. Would we say that the Algerian people made a mistake to fight for their liberation because the French were willing to murder a million of them, that the French were willing to use the most cruel methods of torture against them? So the framing is incorrect. But what I look at is the reality now, which is that Palestinians in Gaza have not stopped resisting. And the videos we've seen in the last couple of days coming out of the resistance in Gaza are extraordinary. These young men running up to tanks and dropping devices in them with their bare hands, and the incident that happened just in the last day or two of 7 Israeli soldiers killed in Gaza. Israel could not conquer Gaza, an enclave that is tiny, that is completely surrounded, that is totally cut off from the outside world. It could not conquer that in 21 months, and people are still fighting there. And the Palestinian society, the people, the ordinary people, have not surrendered. They have not said to Israel, we surrender, we will give you what you want, just stop this. None of them asked for it, asked for the suffering that Israel and Israel alone, with its partners in crime, is inflicting on them, but none of them have submitted to it. And Israel has tried to foster collaboration. And yes, they have this tiny number of a few hundred collaborators, these criminal gangs, the so-called Yasser Abu Shabab gang. But the fact that they have so few and that the people they've actually recruited are these criminal outcasts shows you exactly how a few Palestinians have been willing to collaborate with Israel. So what's extraordinary to me is the strength and resilience of Palestinian society in the face of this genocidal onslaught. And if Palestinians in Gaza are still resisting, nobody has the right to tell them that they made a mistake or they got something wrong by fighting for their liberation and for the liberation of all Palestinians and for the liberation of the world. Because I think the victory in Palestine is the keystone to unraveling centuries of Western colonialism and domination in the world and creating a world where people are sovereign and free and independent in their own land. And that's all that Palestinians want. They don't want, they have no quarrel with the United States or with Europe or with any other place, except to the extent that these countries are supporting these states, because it's not the people. We see across Europe and we see across the United States the immense and growing support for the Palestinian struggle for liberation. It's these governments that support this genocide. And so you can never say that people made a mistake to choose to fight for their freedom, for their liberation. It is only ever the fault of the occupier, the colonizer, and the aggressor for the crimes they did. It's not the fault of the Kenyans, that the crimes that the British Empire committed. It's not the fault of people in India, the crimes that the British Empire committed. So we have to extricate ourselves from even framing things that way.
Very well said. Me personally, I think October 7th, greatest victory from October 7th is the complete collapse of support for Israel in the American public. And growing up, you know, as an activist, part of SJP, things of that nature, the only people we could really communicate to communicate Palestine with were liberals and Democrats and leftists. And obviously the liberals and Democrats would listen to us, but feign support. They weren't really as supportive of Palestinian rights as leftists. But we've seen a major collapse of support for Israel on the right. And it isn't just because of anti-Semitic elements. It's because of genuine horror at the sight of Palestinian Christians, but also just Palestinian babies in general. I mean, we've seen conservatives who historically have been like quite Islamophobic, humanizing Palestinian babies and children, women, even men, because they just cannot stomach the crimes that Israel is committing. And so in my view, I think October 7th, basically that Pew Research poll that came out a couple months ago is a product of October 7th. And I think we all know that the resistance really had no other choice because of the Abraham Accords, which leads me to my next question. Witkoff has recently made an announcement stating that there's going to be a future announcement coming quite soon that new countries are going to be joining the Abraham Accords and that they're going to shift the landscape of the Middle East. We saw a billboard of Donald Trump and a lot of collaborator governments in Tel Aviv. What do you make of this recent development? What sort of betrayal will this be? I mean, we've witnessed so many different betrayals, but this is another extent to expand the Abraham Accords during this genocide. What do you make of the situation? Which countries do you expect to join? And what are your thoughts on this?
Let me just say something about your earlier point about the shift in public opinion, which is global. And you mentioned that Pew Global Research poll. And within the United States, where for the first time ever that I know of, and I've been watching these polls for 30 years, a majority of all Americans now views Israel negatively. That's a historic shift. And on the right. And what's incredible is that after October 7th, we had this massive propaganda onslaught to demonize Palestinians with all the lies about beheaded babies and rapes and all the stuff that we debunked earlier on. And you also did incredible work on that. And people saw through the propaganda. Yes, the diehards, the people who are always going to be in the pro-Israel camp, still bought it. But it's remarkable how much it failed. The billions of dollars of propaganda, that is a remarkable shift. And I think you're right that was already happening. But I think October 7th really accelerated it in a way that a lot of people perhaps would not have expected. Regarding this business about the Abraham Accords, I mean, I saw that billboard and I saw Witkoff's announcement, and I really have no idea which other countries could be joining. I mean, maybe he's talking about Syria, which is run by U.S. And Western intelligence proxy now. I know some people don't like it when I say that, but that's a fact. Sorry. That's why, you know, they thought they were going to do in Iran what they did in Syria, which is basically bring down a government under the pretense that it's to support human rights and install their own people, which is what they've done in Syria. Maybe. But what does it matter? It doesn't matter. They can bring any of these regimes into the so-called Abraham Accords. Doesn't change a thing. What did it change for Israel that they had this, you know, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates joining the Abraham Accords? It won't matter if Saudi Arabia joins up tomorrow. I don't think it will, but it won't matter. Why? Because those countries were de facto allied with Israel anyway. It's just bringing it out of the closet, so to speak. It's making public a relationship that was already there. I think if anything now, it's less possible for any government to publicly embrace Israel, even the most undemocratic, even the one that is most under the thumb of the United States, because it's really awful. And then what is the pitch that Israel makes to these Arab regimes? It's, they sectarianize them. Israel and the United States are the ones that have really stoked the sectarianism in the region, which I think was very hot and very dangerous for a while, but is now kind of thankfully fading away. And it was to one of the methods of trying to incite Arabs against Iran as an independent sovereign state was to say, oh, they're Shia and Shia are bad. And they're against Sunni Muslims. And so we have to have Sunni solidarity, which was completely a recent invented narrative stoked by Israel. And I can even tell you the exact time that Israel lobby groups in the United States started to do that. I mean, it had a longer history, but the more recent period where they started doing that was after Hezbollah's victory against Israel in 2006, when Hezbollah had this massive popularity across the region because it had shown that Israel could be militarily defeated. And so there was this redoubled effort to demonize Hezbollah as this foreign arm of Persian Shia Iran, and a lot of people bought into it, and you had Saudi and Gulf media pouring this poison into people's heads for more than a decade, and a lot of people bought it, and that also was used to stoke the divisions in Syria, which were ultimately used to remove the government there. And what I want to say about that is that Israel's pitch was the real enemy of the Sunni Arab states, they now became defined as Sunni, which again was a completely new invention. The real enemy of the Sunni Arab states is not Israel, but Shia Iran. And therefore, we, Israel, offer you Sunni Arabs an alliance against Iran. And why is that beneficial to you? Because we, Israel, are a regional superpower, and we have the ear of Washington, and we can get you whatever you want from Washington, and we have the technology, and we have the military, and we have the Air Force. So ally with us, and we will protect you, because no one else can protect you from scary Shia Iran. Well, even if you bought that pitch previously, well, look at the situation now, when Israel couldn't defend itself alone. It couldn't even defend itself with all the might of the United States behind it. So if it can't defend itself, how is it going to defend the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia? So Israel's pitch is just a marketing scam. And when you think of the other things Israel claims to offer, technology and startups and all this stuff, well, Israel doesn't have anything unique there. You know, China has the most advanced AI now. There are startups everywhere, tech companies everywhere. Why do you need Israel? Nobody needs Israel. It's all a marketing scam. And so as is the Abraham Accords. And Witkoff and Trump are marketers and flim-flam men, and all they're doing is, you know, they're promising something tomorrow. You know, if they had, why would they say, oh, we're going to have an announcement soon? Well, announce something when you have it. You know, they don't have anything. And so who knows who they'll bring into this? I don't think they have anyone. And if they do, it means nothing.
That is an excellent point. An announcement about an announcement that has yet to materialize.
You see this sometimes. If in your city you see like a big empty lot, and then someone puts up a sign with like a picture of like some luxury condos, and they say coming soon, And then like 10 years later, that sign is faded and there's like grass growing up around it. How many times do you see that? Yeah. It's like that.
Yeah.
Might happen, might not.
Yeah, and I find it hard to believe that, let's say Syria were to normalize with Israel, hard to imagine that the Syrian people who've recently been bombed and occupied by the IDF would be happy to do so. And regardless of the leadership, the Syrian people, like most of the people in the region, simply hate Israel and side with Palestine until the end. So,
Of course. You know, I've always said, and I will say it here, that nobody should have any concern or fear about a democratic Syria. A Syria where the people of Syria can make the choice and steer the country's destiny, because the people of Syria are absolutely solid. Yes, of course, like in any country, not everyone agrees. That's okay. But on those fundamentals, no one should have any doubt about the Syrian people. But that's why the United States will never permit democracy in any country that it's allied with or that is its vassal. That's why, you know, take Jordan, one of the countries where there's a peace treaty. It is universally unpopular in Jordan. The same in Egypt. I mean, I'm sure this is true in the United Arab Emirates. We don't hear much from, you know, Emiratis, because there's so much censorship and so much repression that the only people who are allowed to speak are the ones who support the policy of the regime there. The same with Bahrain and so on. So none of this is popular. If you had democratic governments in any of these countries, none of them would follow this kind of policy, which is why the United States will never allow democracy in any of its vassals, and it will never allow democracy in Syria. And that's why nobody is talking about democracy in Syria now. Nobody is talking about a schedule for elections. I mean, when did you ever hear of a 5-year transitional period of one-man rule in any country that had a so-called popular revolution? It's unheard of, because the policy of the United States is that the Syrian people cannot be allowed to govern themselves. And people need to understand that.
That's an excellent point. I want to ask you about Iran and Israel, the ceasefire agreement, which wasn't even really put on paper. It's really just...
There is no agreement. Yeah, there is no agreement.
It's just a mutual understanding to cede hostilities. But
no, it was what Iran said from the beginning. Iran said, we will punish Israel and we will retaliate as long as Israel attacks us. And if Israel stops attacking us, we will stop retaliating. And that's exactly what happened. And there was no agreement that we know of. Iran has made that very clear. And they retaliated against Israel until the last minute. I saw it. You know, I'm in Jordan, and every time the air raid sirens went off here in Jordan, I don't know why they went off here, because Jordan was never under attack. But it was, you know, that was my sign to go up on the roof and watch the missiles. Iran hammered Israel until the last minute. And they said that if Israel attacks us again, we will retaliate again. So there's been no agreement and no change in Iran's stance.
Yeah, I saw your tweets. Whenever I would hear from like these Iranian accounts that missiles have been fired, I would like, okay, I don't know how you have confirmation of that. But then I would see your tweet saying missile sirens in Jordan. I was like, okay, this is real. You know, another wave has been fired. And it's amazing because it only takes like 10 or 15 minutes.
You know, it's so funny because it's like at the beginning, I was like, it got to like this routine where I knew exactly how it was going to go down. Because I had like, you know, the Israelis get these warnings, and there are these Twitter accounts that basically automatically tweet the warnings that the Israeli Home Front Command sends to all Israelis. So I got notifications from one of those Twitter accounts. So the first thing is that, like, I'd get the notification that is sent to Israelis. They get what's called a pre-warning that says that the IDF has detected missile launches in Iran and that the sirens will go off in a few minutes. And then almost immediately, with the Israeli pre-warning, the sirens would go off in Amman. And then I knew exactly how much time I had to find my sunglasses if it was daytime and get my shoes on and go upstairs. It became like to the point where I
smoke a cigar, have a drink, smile.
I knew it's like okay, I got exactly this much time. Like at the beginning, I'd like be running. It's like, no, it's chill. I know exactly when the missiles are going to come. But it was actually really interesting from the perspective of just seeing how, you know, because I just by coincidence, I happened to be here last October when True Promise 2 happened. And that was like one night where Israel fired hundreds of when Iran fired hundreds of missiles in one night, like over a period of about an hour. And it was this incredible sight where it was just like this river of shooting stars going across the sky and then interceptors going up and like these starbursts. And it was like watching like this Star Wars battle. And it was something I'd never seen before. This time it was, you know, quite different, and watching the tactics change, the Iranian tactics change, and the Israeli, you know, in the beginning, in the first couple of days of this war, it looked a lot more like True Promise 2, like what we saw in October. I would know, before you'd see any Iranian missile, you'd see interceptors go up from the west, from Israel. You'd see these rockets come up from the west. And then I'd know, okay, like in about 20 seconds, I'm going to look behind me and I'm going to see an Iranian missile coming from the east over my shoulder. And it was like clockwork. It was really interesting. Incredible. But then towards the end, when the Iranians were using these new missiles, they would come in. They don't come in from behind you. It's sort of at this low angle and travel across the sky and come down at this shallow angle towards the west, towards Palestine. They would come in front of you from straight up and shoot straight down. Mm. And the Israeli interceptors never came up to meet them. Mm. And it was astonishing. They were so fast that if you didn't already have your video camera running, you would not have time.
Yeah.
They were like lightning. You would see, sometimes I could just get a picture of the smoke trail, but the missile itself came down so fast that if you didn't, so I would be standing there with just the video camera running and scanning the sky because I wanted to catch them. Because if you didn't do it that way, they were just so quick. So you could see all that with the naked eye. So, you know, when you'd hear these reports about, oh, Iran says it's using a new kind of missile, I'd know this isn't just propaganda because I could actually see it. You could see the difference with the naked eye. So it was pretty remarkable to watch this. I mean, just from that sort of that perspective of like what it looks like, I learned a lot.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was in Iran the beginning of May. I was there with Max Blumenthal and others for the Subh Media Festival. And we took a tour of the Aerospace Museum and I saw these rockets for myself. And you can see the progression over time, the innovation on the rockets. And I saw the Fateh missile, which apparently was used for the first time during this conflict. There's debate over whether that's true or not, but apparently they did use it. And that's a hypersonic missile that at its fastest, I think, they said like Mach 15 or Mach 18, something insane. You know, it's like that at its top speed will travel like 10 miles per second, which is crazy to think about. And that's why it looked like a lightning strike. And that's why Israel's missiles just can't intercept it because it's moving so fast. And it's incredible that a nation under sanctions could develop that and do so with the full intent to defend themselves from Western imperialism. It's like everything they've been building towards for the last 50 years on full display. And it worked. Obviously, it worked because, you know, this was a conflict that came to an end or a pause, at least, in 12 days, you know, where Israel's used to just kind of dominating whoever they want, whenever they want, flying over their airspace and just obliterating them and having no reason to stop. You know, in this case, they had to be saved by the U.S., one, and two, even the U.S. couldn't save them. They had to just bring it to an end.
Yeah, and I think this is an important point to make on this, because I saw a lot of people saying, oh, well, why did Iran agree to stop? If they were hammering Israel so hard, if Israel was defenseless, why did they stop? Why didn't they just keep going? Or why didn't they say, well, we won't stop until, you know, Israel stops bombing Gaza? And I think that's a good question. And it's an important point to address. And I think the answer, the conclusion I've come to is there's two things. Iran's strategy has never been to defeat Israel through direct military confrontation. These missiles are defensive. They're meant as a deterrent. Iran supports resistance across the region. And if Iran did want to fight a war against Israel directly, presumably they would want to do that at the time of their choosing, not when they're subject to this surprise attack and they're not ready and so on. Even though it's remarkable how quickly Iran rallied and was able to hit back on the same day. But I think the other thing is you have to kind of game this out. What would have happened if Israel's missile defenses completely collapsed and ran out and Iran was still hammering it? Well, the U.S. didn't want to come in and do a regime change war. They realized that the initial Israeli strike failed to induce regime change, and they decided, we're not going to come in and do a regime change war. That's too risky. That's too costly. But if the survival of Israel was at stake, the U.S. would definitely have come in, and they would have mounted a strategic bombing campaign that would have destroyed Iran's industry, its institutions, its infrastructure, killed thousands of people, and set Iran back decades. And what would that have achieved? That wouldn't have achieved anything, because Iran's strategy is about building itself up, strengthening its relationships with the global South and supporting the legitimate resistance across the region. And that's in keeping with its longstanding strategy. It's never been to, you know, Iran isn't building up its missiles so that it can one day launch them all at Israel. And asymmetrical warfare, which is what there is when you have a colonized weaker side, which is what the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and Iran and Yemen are, because they're facing the might of the entire US-led empire, the weaker side fights asymmetrically. Their goal is never to defeat the colonizer or the stronger side in a single blow. This is not a video game. There will be no video game ending to Israel. It is a strategy of wearing the occupier down, wearing them down, attrition, basically. That's how resistance movements fight. That's how the Vietnamese defeated the French in the United States. It's how the Kenyans defeated the British. It's how the South Africans defeated the apartheid regime. And it is how the Palestinian people are defeating Israel. It's an incredibly painful process that is very costly for people. But no one has ordered Palestinians. It wasn't Iran. You know, Palestinians aren't the proxy of Iran like the propaganda. It's a struggle that Palestinians have chosen to wage, and Palestinians deserve respect and support for waging that struggle like any other people who's trying to free itself.
Ali, I just want to end with one final question for you. What message of hope do you have for people that are struggling to understand how this is still happening in Gaza? Obviously, Iran has dominated the headlines for the last few weeks, but the genocide continues in Gaza. The resistance fights on, and they're fighting bravely, and the people support them. But it's hard to see people starving to death and get shot and killed, you know, just trying to get water or food. And it's clear that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is being used to kind of focus and center the population closer and closer to the Egyptian border. The fear is that they will dump them into Egypt. What message do you have for people that need to understand what their role is and how they can potentially assist the people of Gaza and how we can bring this to an end, despite the fact that everything that has been done hasn't really, you know, produced the change we want to see yet?
Mm. Two things. One is to remember that as cruel as Israel and its supporters are, they haven't gotten their way yet. They have caused immense suffering, which they alone are responsible for causing in Gaza. But they haven't expelled the people. If Israel had its way, there would be no Palestinians left in Gaza. They don't control an inch of Gaza. To this day, the Israelis don't control an inch of Gaza. There is nowhere in Gaza where the Israelis can let down their guard because the resistance is still there. And I can only reflect what our friends, our colleagues in Gaza tell me every time I speak to them. They say, what keeps our hope alive, what keeps us going through indescribable horror and suffering is when we see people in the rest of the world talking about us, demonstrating, demanding that their governments act, never letting an opportunity pass to talk about Gaza. So that's what we have to keep doing. We have to keep doing it. And it is having an effect. It's not having an effect as fast as we want. The suffering is unbearable, but it is having an effect. You talked about the sea change in global opinion. You know, we can all see it. So we were a tiny minority at one point in the West. Now we are the majority. So we have to keep going. The hope is in us. The hope is in our collective action, our individual action. And there's no action that's too small. Me, as someone, as a Palestinian, I get so moved when I'm just going down the street, in Ireland or in the US. I was in Ireland a few weeks ago, or in the US, and I see a Palestinian flag in someone's window, or I see a sign that talks about Gaza. And when other people see that, it gives them the permission that, yes, I can talk about this. It helps people break the fear factor. So people just speaking out, being visible, as well as going to demonstrations, as well as speaking up on social media, joining boycott, divestment, and sanction campaigns. That's the hope. Don't sit there and despair. Act. Speak out. It matters.
And with that, we come to the close of this week's episode. As always, stay curious. Stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power, break through silence, and light the way toward justice. I'm Bethany Marks, your host and narrator. It has been a profound honor to share this space with you. A space where truth is spoken without compromise, where resistance is carried with reverence, and where solidarity is never conditional, and never up for negotiation. If you have reflections, questions, or if you feel called to step behind the mic as a future host, we welcome your voice. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult road with us. And to the brilliant team, whose vision and dedication keep this platform alive. Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Abby Masri, Juliette Salamet Olivier, Renaud Algoul, and our editor, Mohamed Algoul. Your labor, your spirit, and your unwavering commitment are the heartbeat of this show. You remind us each week that storytelling is not merely a craft. It is resistance. It is care. It is collective memory. Until next time, keep walking toward truth. Keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay steadfast. Free Palestine. شيل شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالم ويلو ويلو من الله نسهر على نجوم الليل انا لا ويلو شيل
الشيل عالجمال يشيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليلى ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل أنا داويلة شيل شيل عالجمال يشيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليلى ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل أنا داويلة